Welcome back to the Maniac Radio Show, everyone. I'm Airman First Class Bridget Rosignol, reporting from the 101st Air Refueling Wing in Bangor, Maine. Today, it is my distinct honor to welcome Colonel Sarah Clapp, Deputy Commander of the 101st Air Refueling Wing, to the show. Colonel Clapp is responsible for supporting the full spectrum of command, discipline, training, and morale for the wing. She assists the wing commander in organizing, training, and equipping over 1,100 airmen stationed in Bangor and the geographically separated unit in South Portland to project air refueling, combat communications, and engineering capabilities globally in support of national security objectives. Colonel Clapp, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to sit down with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So just to give a little context to our listeners regarding this four-day drill weekend, we have the UEI taking place, the Unit Effectiveness Inspection, or the FRI. Although the UEI is really a year-round continuous process, as you've all been saying, can you explain to our less familiar listeners what exactly it is and how it makes the dynamic of drill weekend a little different, if at all?
Yes, so the Foundational Readiness Inspection has replaced what we used to call the UEI. And it is a little bit different. We're looking at readiness items, commander's inspection programs, and attachment 3 programs throughout the wing. So it is a little bit different, but we're doing the same thing. We're looking at all of our processes to see where we can improve. And the mindset that we need to have, that's beneficial to have, is that the inspectors are here to help us. So it is business as usual. Everyone should be continuing on with their training, with the normal rhythm of drill weekend. But we have inspectors here that are going to stop people, look at programs, ask some questions. A lot of that has already happened before. They just now have a chance to speak with our people, to clarify anything, to get a sense of how we operate here. And so my hope is that we will be really open and genuine and excited for what they have to give us for feedback, that we will take it as an opportunity to bring the programs we know are good to the next level and to identify anything that might not be going well. Sometimes we're not resourced appropriately for things. It's a chance to show, hey, we need help here. We need to resource either equipment or people towards this requirement, and we've been unable to do that. So they're also here as advocates for us. They can advocate and say, yes, this unit isn't appropriately resourced. They do need help here, and they can provide some of that. So it's honestly a great opportunity and nothing to be nervous about.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point that it's important that everyone here is just doing business as normal, right? Because if they try to put on a show, maybe do things a little bit differently than they usually do, they're not able to get that genuine feedback that we need.
Absolutely. And we know we have good programs here. We have great people. We have great programs. We're not perfect, and we're never going to be perfect, and that's okay. So it is really important that the inspectors get a sense of who we are and what we do here, and that it's really genuine, not trying to cover up anything, just using it as a growth opportunity.
Yeah. Aside from the formal job description of what being the deputy commander at an Air National Guard air refueling wing entails, tell us what a typical day in your life presents, if such a thing exists.
So I live in Blue Hill, which is about an hour away. I get up at between 4 and 4:30 in the morning. My husband is also a commander in the unit, and we have 3 children. So I've got a 10-year-old daughter, an 8-year-old daughter, and a 4-year-old son, and life is a little bit crazy all the time. So my parents come to our house at 6:30 in the morning. One of them will come to help get the kids ready and bring them either to school or right now summer camps, so that my husband David, or Colonel Gribben, and I can get to work on time. We try to get here early because then we leave and we have kids in 3 different sports teams and 2 different music lessons, and we are running around all the time. So that is the picture of life. Anytime someone asks me how things are going, my answer is usually it's really good but really crazy. And work doesn't change, so it's just as hectic here as it is outside. I typically would rather engage with people than do admin. While of course there's necessary admin that I have to do, I am running around and talking with people about issues and engaging with people that come into my office all the time, which I really love and am energized by, but it's it's a lot, and it means every day is different because there are different issues and different people that would like my time.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point that a lot of what we talk about for service members is how important our families are in our service. You know, we couldn't do a lot of the things that we do without those people on the outside supporting us from the outside. So thank you for sharing that and letting everyone know that your job's crazy here, but it's crazy on the outside too, and all of it is what makes you you. Yes. So thank you so much for sharing that. Bringing it back to the beginning of your Air Force career, being a 2006 graduate of the Air Force Academy, something I'm always curious about to know about Academy graduates is when you decided or how you knew that you wanted to become an officer, and if the Air Force Academy was the only one that you applied to.
So that is a great question. I knew nothing about the Air Force Academy or the military. I am not from a military family. And my high school has senior debates. So when I was a junior, the end of my junior year, I went to one of the senior debates. Two of my friends were debating, two of the girls on the soccer team were debating two guys on their soccer team about whether or not women should be in the military. So I went to the debate to support them, and it was sort of a absurd premise, and you know, they were showing videos of women like falling off obstacles and different things. And then a teacher of mine, my favorite teacher, was the boys' soccer coach, so he also happened to go to the debate. I went into the gym after with him, and he was just sort of poking fun at me. He said, "You couldn't be in the military. You can't even kill a spider." And I said, "Well, I'm going to look into it." And so, as a joke, I went to the guidance office, or just maybe out of spite, I went to the guidance office and I picked out the first military-related book that I could find. And it happened to be a brochure for the Air Force Academy. So I brought it home, and I remember reading through the brochure, reading things out loud to my parents. At the time, I was notoriously late to everything, and my room was always a mess. And so I was reading through the typical day of a cadet. And I remember my dad laughing and saying, "Yeah, that's not for you." So that's how it started. And over the summer, I turned it over in my mind. I was big into sports. I really liked being part of something bigger than myself. And the colleges that I was looking to go to, I couldn't play sports at. So I was looking at just being a student. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that negatively, but to me that just didn't feel like enough. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the summer, right before my senior year, I decided, you know, I'm just going to apply and just see what happens. I was really late in the process. Most people know much earlier that they're going to apply to a service academy. There are earlier steps that need to happen. But somewhere along the way through that application process, it became my first choice. But it was the only military-related school I applied to. If I had not gone to the Air Force Academy, I would have gone to Bowdoin. That was my second choice school there. And when I did get in, my parents would not allow me to accept it till we went. They really were concerned about it. We didn't know anything about it. I spent a few months answering questions from family about why I wanted to do this, hearing stories about my second cousin's uncle who enlisted in the Army and hated it. Yeah. And, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I had people come up to me and say, "Oh, you're such a smart girl. You should go to college." There's just no understanding of what it was. And as soon as we went in person my senior year to see, we didn't even get off the bus. And my mom turned to me. She said, "This is what you're going to do, isn't it?" I said, "Yes."
That's a very unique story. I mean, that's incredible. You don't often hear somebody taking the academy route to become an officer without really any prior knowledge or interest before the fact. So following the academy, you continued to pursue multiple avenues of advanced education. How do you compare or weigh the importance of formalized training and education versus on-the-job lived experiences?
So I will say that I love school. I'm a person that really enjoys learning. I really enjoy college, formal classes, grad school. I love to learn new things, and I love that environment. I like having my ideas challenged. I like being able to learn how to think. I have forgotten more that I learned than I remember, and so there's a place for both, I guess. The most important thing about formal schooling to me is learning how to learn and learning how to think, how to examine your own assumptions. And that is really important when you go into on-the-job learning. One of the things I say to myself a lot is I am confident in my ability to learn. And going into different situations over and over again, going through those different schools and different programs, things like grad school, but also pilot training, which is a different kind of learning altogether. Going through those challenging programs, even if I don't remember most of what I learned in them or don't use it directly in my job, I now can go into a new job and say, I don't know any of this, but I am confident in my ability to learn. I know I can figure it out. And that is my biggest takeaway. In the last 3 years, I have gone through 3 different jobs, each one more outside my comfort zone than the last and farther away from my traditional area of expertise and my career leading up to that point. First in maintenance, then in the mission support group, and now as the wing deputy. And that mantra has carried me through a lot of that. The first 6 months of a new job can be overwhelming. And I tell myself that all the time, and people that work for me too, hey, I don't know it right now, but because I've gone through all of this formal schooling and informal on-the-job situations, I am confident in my ability to learn. I know I can figure it out. And that to me is more important than whatever specific knowledge I gained in any program.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very true what you said about just transferable skills. Any job that you have, you can always take something from it to bring it on to the next. Even if you're going into complete foreign territory, there's something you can always pull from a past experience that can help you as you're navigating the new experience.
So, yes, 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. So touching on to this pilot experience that you were just mentioning, so you've flown thousands of hours across several aircraft and now serve as a deputy commander of an air refueling wing. How has your view of leadership evolved throughout your career from the cockpit to the command post?
So pilot careers are unique from many other officer careers in that you spend the first half of your career really focused on developing your individual skill set and your expertise in your craft. It takes years to go through the education that you need through pilot training, becoming a co-pilot, getting the hours you need to upgrade to aircraft commander, and then instructor pilot. That takes years to do. So you're not in charge of very many people. You're really in charge of yourself, and you're focused on your own skill set. You're focused on your own character, becoming a person that people would want to follow. But you don't have a lot of formal opportunity to lead big groups of people. Leadership in the cockpit is really important, but it's different. You have, in the KC-135, you've got a basic crew of 3. So you're leading yourself and 2 other people. When I first became a commander in AMXS, I was a lieutenant colonel, and that was really the first opportunity I had to lead a group of people outside of the plane. And it is a shift because now it's not about your expertise, your personal expertise anymore. It's about enabling the people that work for you. And I am so glad I had the opportunity to command in maintenance outside of my area of primary career because I am a different commander and a different leader than I would have been if I had started off in operations. I think the reason for that is that I really understood in the first half of my career the importance of instilling confidence in people I'm leading in my own competence. Nobody wants an aircraft commander who they're worried doesn't know what's happening in the plane. And so I had this idea of leadership that I have to be the best at everything for the people that I'm leading. And if I had gone right into ops as a commander, it would have been very tempting to think that the way I was going to lead is to show people how it was done in every area. Hey, I've been in scheduling before. I've been in these different shops. I can show you the best way to do it. I can lead in that way. And same with the airplane, with the flying. Hey, I'm a good pilot. I can show you how to run these programs. It would have been tempting to operate that way. But in maintenance, it was clear from day one, I am never going to be the expert in fixing this plane. So what is my role here? As a commander, of course, I want people to be confident that I can do my job well, that I can advocate well for them, that I can represent them well. So you need to be competent, but what does that mean? It's not being an expert in all of these things. So it really shifted my focus almost overnight to, okay, I need to clear the barriers for the people who are experts in all of these things. I need to educate myself and know enough to advocate appropriately, but I don't need to be the expert. I don't need to be the smartest person in the room. I need to enable the smartest person in the room on any given subject. So it really shifted the way I look at leadership, and I'm glad, because I could have had a tendency to micromanage. And if you're only using your own expertise, no matter how smart you are, even if you are the smartest person in the room, if you're only utilizing yourself, you are missing out on the potential of the organization.
You bring up a good point that I actually talked with SEA Raines with on the last podcast. Was he mentioned that part of being a good leader in his eyes is being able to be resourceful, in the sense that, like you said, you don't have to be the expert in the room. It's finding the people that are and leveraging those people and their skills to get the job done. So you've served in Japan, New Jersey, Kansas, Maine, all over the place. How has serving in such diverse locations and flying globally influenced your perspective on the role that the Air National Guard plays in both local and international operations?
So my first assignment was in Wichita, Kansas, at McConnell Air Force Base, and the ops tempo there was crushing. I deployed 4 times in my first year and a half as a co-pilot at McConnell. The Air National Guard was taking a third of our lines, so they were covering a third of our lines that were assigned to McConnell, and even so, that was the ops tempo we had. So my initial view of the Guard wasn't well informed, but it was very grateful that, thank goodness, they're taking a third of these lines, because I don't know how we would do this without them. You also see guard crews deployed, and they are the cool kids, and so there's some jealousy. Oh man, I wish I could be them. They generally seemed much happier than we were, to have a lot more autonomy, to be treated better. It was a challenging time. Now that I've transitioned out and I'm out of active duty, part of the Guard, it's so clear to me that the active duty does not understand the Guard at all. So I had that small picture from our interaction with crews, but the average person on active duty has no idea about statuses. They have no idea what a drill status guardsman does or the challenges they have, and you don't think much about it. We operate in an active duty run Air Force, and the policies do not always align. They are not favorable or supportive to the Guard just because of that lack of understanding. It's easy to dismiss drill status guardsmen, even full-timers in the Guard. It's easy to dismiss them because you get caught up in the job that you're doing and wishing you had more support and resources, and then you have drill status guardsmen come in and they don't have access to the computer, and they don't know everything that you know, because they haven't been doing this job day in and day out. But my perspective now is that drill status guardsmen are the most impressive group of service members that we have. It is so challenging to be in a completely different role during the week, to be disconnected from the unit. Your life is elsewhere, largely. And to then come in, to sacrifice your time in your normal life, your normal job, your family, to come in, to have all of these barriers often to computer access, to the training you need. No one feels comfortable coming in and not being really good at their job. Nobody likes that. No one likes to come in and feel like, I don't have enough time to do everything. I don't have enough time to get spun up. I want to be really good at this. I want to be really excellent. Sometimes we haven't given DSGs the resource to do that or the time to do that. That's really challenging. And again, their full-time paying job is elsewhere. So DSGs are often not coming for the money, because they need the benefits, because they need the money. There are good benefits and pay, but often they're doing it because they just want to serve. They want to be the reserve force for our nation in case of the worst case scenario, to supplement our full-time force. So that has been a huge shift from my active duty days to today.
Yeah, as a drill status guardsman myself, I appreciate that perspective, and that you have that active duty time to then, you know, reflect on the differences and then the challenges that the different statuses can present. So I appreciate that perspective a lot. Which of those assignments was your favorite over the years?
Kadena. Kadena in Okinawa, Japan. It was an amazing assignment. And I was honestly very bitter leaving McConnell, and Kadena saved my Air Force experience for me. Overseas, fighter base, very, very dynamic. It was almost like being deployed in place because the schedule was daily. You didn't have a lot of predictability, but you were in this tropical paradise surrounded by great people doing the same thing. Everyone's far away from home, and it really made you a family. So that squadron was so close. The flying was really interesting. We were flying all over Asia, a lot of real world stuff. So you feel like what you're doing matters. You can see the direct impact of that. I had my oldest daughter the last year I was out there, and she was 6 weeks early. I hadn't even had my baby shower yet, so I had nothing that I needed. And my family is halfway across the world. I had arranged childcare based on her due date, but I had nothing. And the squadron pulled together. I don't think I made a meal for myself for 2 months. We were in the NICU for over a week. When I came home, my whole room was set up with all the baby stuff that I needed, with a crib, with changing stuff, with diapers, with clothes. It was amazing. And that's the kind of thing that happens when no one has family support and it's hard to get away. So it was a very unique assignment, really wonderful assignment, great friends. I still get together with friends from that assignment every year. We go to different places around the country to have a little reunion every year.
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point that not everyone in the military gets to experience, especially if they're just one term and done. Not everyone gets the experience of being stationed overseas somewhere. So that's a very unique perspective that you become each other's family when you're out there because you're all going through the same stuff. You all have family that's back across the pond, and it's what you do with that new family that really gets you through. So
absolutely. And any assignment can be an amazing assignment because of the people. That's really what makes or breaks an assignment.
Yeah, absolutely. So with over 1,500 combat hours across multiple operations, including Operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, to name a few, what stands out to you most about these high-stake missions and what you've taken from those experiences that has shaped the way you both lead and follow in your current role?
The training that we go through as aircrew really is designed to improve your response to stress over what your natural response would be. And so the most critical situations I've had in the plane, looking back, I've been really proud of the way that my crew has responded because it's so easy to panic, and naturally we do panic when bad things happen and have poor communication, to not think clearly and not speak clearly. And those situations of high stress are the times when you need to be communicating the most clearly and completely of any situation. And then you need to be able to utilize your crew to make sure that you aren't missing anything. I would say that it's a hard balance in the aircraft to instill confidence in the crew that you know what you're doing, but also create a dynamic where the lowest ranking person, a 20-year-old new A1C boom operator, can speak up in a critical situation and challenge you when something is not correct. That can be a hard dynamic, but it's so important. And it illustrates why ops is a little bit different in their environment, in their culture. It's because of this. I want my crew to have confidence in my ability as a pilot, but I also need that crew member to speak up, any crew member to speak up if something is wrong. Boom operators are particularly unique, I think, within the aircrew community. We give them great authority and responsibility in the jet. And they often have the best situational awareness in a crisis because the pilots are busy, they're talking on the radios, there's a lot going on flying the plane. They are often sitting in the jump seat, taking everything in. So that's the member of the crew I need to be able to speak up. And I've had boom operators save me from bad situations multiple times. So we tend to downplay formality of rank in the aircraft for that reason. You use first names, you use crew position, you are much less deferent because of the safety aspect and crew resource management. And I think that is still the way I try to operate outside of the cockpit now. The stakes aren't quite the same, but I need the people with the good ideas who see the problems and who think that they have a great way to fix it to speak up. I know I do not have all of the best ideas. I know I do not have all the solutions to the problems in this wing. So I still need to create an environment where an A1C can come up to me and say, hey, ma'am, this isn't right, and feels empowered to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's really from my time in those critical situations in the cockpit.
Yeah, and that really ties back well to what we started off this podcast with, talking about the fry, giving everybody the, you know, the confidence and the opportunity to speak up when they see things that you may not see. Last year, just this time last year, really, I had just wrapped up my initial upgrade training when you were coming into headquarters and getting settled. And I noticed right away that the way you speak to people creates such an open and inviting dynamic where conversation and questions are encouraged. How do you personally aim to keep your morale and that of your team high? Any go-to leadership hacks, jokes, or rituals that you try to stick to?
So as a really simple guideline, the most important part of my job are the people I'm going to encounter on any given day. I also think that as you go up in rank, as you're a commander, as you're a colonel, there are barriers to people coming to talk with you. So if somebody comes to my office, if they thought it was important enough to come to my office to tell me something, I am going to give them my full attention. I'm going to stop what I'm doing and, to the best of my ability, if it's within my control, they will have my full attention for as long as they need it. I think that when people feel valued, when people feel heard, even when things aren't going well, that is the most important element in creating a culture and a dynamic where people want to come to work. I also think my personal morale is really influenced by my faith, and I have great joy and purpose in coming to work. And I think that joy is contagious. When you really are passionate about what you're doing, when you feel fulfilled in that, when you are excited to be at work, I think that that creates an environment for everybody that catches. They want to be part of that. They get excited about whatever it is that we're doing, even if it's something small and mundane.
I mean, I know for sure that if I walk into a room and everybody seems down and nobody's talking, it's you definitely pick up on that energy. So if you can be that person that brings the spark, that's really awesome. So in 2008, you took part in a publication titled When the Boss is a Woman, the Psychology of Women at Work, Challenges and Solutions for Our Female Workforce, which based on the timestamp, I assume was part of your master's degree. Was that correct? So tell us a little bit about the research that you took part in to write this piece and some key takeaways. And this really ties in well to your story of how you decided to pursue the Air Force Academy.
So I had a great opportunity to write an article as part of my grad school program that went into a textbook on women in leadership. So my master's degree was on social psychology, but really with a focus on gender differences and leadership in particular. I just find that fascinating. And there was a lot covered in that research, but what has endured and really stuck with me was the fact that men and women really can both be equally successful in leadership positions, but they have access to different tools, and they do that differently. It's easy to get frustrated that that's the case and to think, well, I should be able to act just like my male counterparts. But the reality is, the truth is, that's not true. There are different expectations for men and women within society. A lot of that has changed. But for me to just be angry that it's not exactly equal or exactly the same doesn't help me in any way. And leadership, while this is changing in particular, we often associate the characteristics of strong leaders with, they align with the characteristics that we associate with strong men. But a lot of the characteristics of strong or good women are counter to that. And a good example is ambition. Things that are very direct communication, we allow men to behave that way without judging them because it aligns with the way we see men in general and the way men should be, but it doesn't align with the way we think women should be. And so with a lot of female leaders, we either make a decision in our judgment that they are a competent, good leader, but a bad woman. That's the wrong way to say that, but violating the norms of their gender role. And so personally, we dislike them, even though we see them as highly competent. Mm-hmm. or we see them as nice and motherly and all the things that society stereotypically thinks women should be, but then we don't see them as very competent. So there's some disparity between those roles that can be challenging, that men don't always have to navigate. But one of the big things that's so important to understand is that men deal with the same thing, just about different issues. And so the reality is men and women both have challenges, and there are behaviors that are acceptable for both genders that aren't acceptable for the other, or that people don't receive as well. There are certain leadership situations that women are viewed much more favorably in. And that was really important for me to understand, hey, there are differences. I'm going to have different tools. I need to be authentic to who I am and the talents that I have, but I can do this. I can navigate. There's a path. It's not just a hopeless story here. And the other part that's so important is there is real sexism, right? There are real barriers that women have to deal with, but most of the time, people do not wish you ill. So there are certain individuals once in a while who truly are sexist and don't think women should be in a leadership role, but that's not the norm. And so there are biases that people have when they actually really want what's best for you that you need to have grace for them in. You need to assume the best about that person's motivation and treat them that way, because that's not the way they meant it. And a good example I have, when I was going through my intro flight screening program, I had an older gentleman pilot who was my flight commander, and he really wanted to help me. I struggled a lot because I was airsick. I'd never flown before, and I was behind because I was sick all the time. So I really struggled to get through that program. He wanted me to do well. And before one of my flights, I remember him telling me that I needed to put in my man brain, because men's brains are like waffles and they're good at compartmentalizing, and women's brains are like spaghetti and we're not very good at that. And so he was trying to encourage me. He said, okay, I need you to put in your man brain to go fly today. And wow, I could have been super offended by that. And the reality is, I don't think that's particularly true or helpful to me, but I also recognize he is, within the best of his ability, trying to help me. He is not trying to hold me back. He is not hoping that I fail out. He is trying to do his best to help me. When you decide not to be offended and see, give the person the benefit of the doubt, assume the best about their intentions, then you have so much more ability to correct those wrong assumptions, right? If you genuinely care about that person and you treat them that way, then I can say, hey, you know what? This wasn't very helpful to me. You might not want to use that line with other women that you're teaching to fly, right? It's easy to be offended. It's easy because a lot of that discrimination is real, but it's not a benefit to you. It really does not, it harms you more than anybody to be looking for that everywhere, to feel like the reason you're not successful are these barriers that other people have. So it's a balance, understanding that does really exist, but not allowing yourself to operate that way, treat people that way, and be defined by that.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point that it's not the norm for people to wish, you know, ill intent on somebody. That's not usually the intention, right? So in challenging those moments where you can, you know, let this person know that maybe that wasn't the best way to speak to somebody or go about something, most people, I think, would receive that and do something about it and change it, right? And those people that aren't, you tried. Right? And that's at that point, you know, it's not your job to try and fix that.
I am a big believer in feedback. Mm-hmm. I think feedback is a gift. And I think that we often, it's human nature to shy away from hard conversations. Mm-hmm. It's easy to do, but they're so important. And that's just one example of a hard conversation, but we deal with them all the time. Just giving normal feedback to a peer or a subordinate who's not performing well. And you don't have the ability to effectively speak into someone's life about a hard topic if you do not genuinely care about that person first. Mm-hmm. And so you can say the same words, but want to put someone in their place, and it feels different and they know it, right? I can have the exact same conversation, but if my heart is in the wrong place, they are not going to hear it and receive it. So there are times where I have hard feedback to give somebody and my heart's not in the right place about it, and I have to delay a few days and actually do some heart work and examine, do I want the best for this person? What does love require of me in this situation? And what I mean by love is not primarily an affectionate feeling, but genuinely wanting the best for that person. And when you are in that spot where I genuinely want this person to succeed and do well, now the hard feedback feels different. And they can sense it whether the words are the same or not. And that applies to every human interaction, leadership situation, peer interaction that we're talking about. Those are conversations we don't do well. And I think that's the piece that's missing most of the time, assuming the best, giving benefit of the doubt, and genuinely wanting what's best for that person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, like you said, it's important to, if you need that time, to figure out exactly the way you want to go about this hard conversation. Take all the time you need to make sure it comes across the right way and the way that you intend it to. Yeah. So with Family Day coming up on base this weekend, many airmen will be bringing their children, siblings, friends on base to get a glimpse of what we do here. If you had the opportunity to speak to a civilian guest toying with the idea of potentially joining the Maine or National Guard, what's a piece of advice or information you'd like to share with that individual?
I would say, if you want to be part of something bigger than yourself, if you want to be part of a family, if you want to do extraordinary things, we have a place for you here. In our newcomers briefs, we often talk about, if you come into the Guard and you're not satisfied with where you are, if the job doesn't seem to be the right fit, talk to us, because we have so many diverse opportunities. You may not have been in the right place initially, but we have a place for you. If you're a hard worker, do your best where you are, and you will have a lot of different opportunities, and it's really valuable. We need all sorts of different people with all sorts of different bents and skills and talents and ways of viewing the world. We need that. So That's really what I would say.
That's a great point. I think that that's something that, I don't know if this gets brought up to airmen that are thinking about getting out for their first term. I don't know if people bring it up to them that, have you tried a different career, thought about a different career? Maybe that'll kind of switch up your mindset about things. I personally, when I was looking into this role here about 2 years ago now, it was the first time this job was open in like 6 years. So for me, it was perfect timing. I can't imagine being in any other position. I mean, I love what I do here. So what kind of advice can you provide to an airman that, you know, they're pretty set on leaving, they're not having a good time? Have you ever approached anyone and suggested that maybe they look into another career field?
Anytime I do an exit interview with someone who's leaving, we talk about this. And often it's just family circumstances, they've got outside opportunities, or they're moving, that's fine. I try to keep the door open to them and thank them for their service. But yes, absolutely explore. Hey, if you're not happy here, we have other opportunities, different environments, and would you be interested in pursuing that? Often they aren't. By the time they get to me, they've already made the decision. They're well on their way out. Mm-hmm. And so I try to treat that person well and encourage them, so that in the future, if your circumstances change and you'd like to come in and try something different, reconsider. Just reach out, let me know. We can make that happen. And once in a while, you do have someone who leaves for a while and then they choose to come back. They go to a different unit or they get out entirely and then they choose to come back if they're treated well, mm-hmm. and with respect and dignity.
Well, Colonel Clapp, do you have anything else that you'd like to add to this story today before we wrap things up? Anything else you wanted to share?
We started the day today recognizing you and all that you've been doing here. Very impressive, particularly with the short time that you've been here. The recognition that you've been getting for your photos and your work at Atlantic Trident. And I'm very impressed overall with you and with the whole PA shop doing some great things. This podcast is an example of going above and beyond what is required. And I just really appreciate it. Appreciate being here today.
Thank you so much. I wasn't expecting a plug on my own podcast, but thank you so much. I really appreciate those kind words. And thank you for taking some of your very valuable time to kick off August Drill Weekend with me. I appreciate you sharing your experiences and expertise on this episode of the Maniac Radio Show.
You're welcome. And thank you for having me.